The American POTUS Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit show supported by listener patriots just like you. To help us keep the program going, please join others around the nation by considering a tax-deductible donation. You can make your contribution and see what exciting plans we have for new podcasts and other outreach programs at AmericanPOTUS.org. Thank you for your support, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Coming up on American POTUS, Warren Harding. World War I had just wrapped up, and the nation was desperate for a return to normalcy. So who's more normal than a small-town man from the Midwest? Well, he was elected in a landslide and seemed to have a fairly successful presidency. But after he got sick and died in office, trouble started bubbling to the surface. It seems while Harding may have been a good guy in office, his cabinet was anything but. Several scandals were revealed, ruining his reputation as a POTUS. We're giving Warren Harding his due, the good, the bad, and the controversial, on this episode of American POTUS. I'm Scott Brun. With the help of presidential scholar Alan Lowe, we're opening the book on the men who have held our nation's highest office. By sharing their challenges, their stories, and their personalities, we hope to add some clarity and perspective for today's heated political conversations. We want to know more about our 29th POTUS, and Sherry Hall may be the best in the nation to give us the inside scoop. For over 20 years, she's been focused on the lives and times of the president and his family, including the last 9 years as the site manager of the Warren G. Harding Presidential Sites in Marion, Ohio. Sherry, we are thrilled to have you on the show. Let's talk about President Harding. Here we go.
That's what everybody says. They want to talk about President Harding.
Well, Sherry, I'm excited to learn more. President Harding is a president I need to know more about, and really happy to have you on American POTUS. You know, before we jump into his time in the White House, I want to learn a bit more about his background. When and where was he born, and what was his family life like growing up?
Well, he's an Ohio farm boy. He is born in 1865, so he's going to be our first president born after the conclusion of the Civil War. Born in a little tiny village that you've never heard of, probably, called Blooming Grove, Ohio. If I told you it's near Galion, you haven't heard of Galion either, so suffice it to say, it's a very tiny little village. It's in Morrow County, Ohio, which is kind of north central Ohio. Blooming Grove was founded by the Harding family in 1820. So as the family started to migrate from Pennsylvania, as the family's moving west, they come into Ohio in 1820 and establish Blooming Grove. So Warren grows up among lots of relatives, not only his immediate family, but grandparents, great-grandparents, cousins. So he has a really happy childhood in Blooming Grove. He's there only till about the age of six. And then the family, the immediate family, picks up and moves to another big burg called Caledonia, Ohio, about 20 miles west towards Marion. And they are coming this way because his father, whose name is George Tryon Harding, he is a farmer, but he's also a doctor. He's a homeopathic doctor, and it's frankly going to be a little busier area, hopefully, for him to get some more patients. The family is not rich by any stretch. There's eight kids eventually between Blooming Grove and Caledonia. Warren is the oldest. He works in the summers when he's not in school. He is shucking corn. He's painting barns. He's repairing railroad ties. So, you know, it's a hardworking family.
I know that he gets into the newspaper business. Is that in his family background in any way? How did he learn that, or did he study that in school?
He was always good at writing and debates. And in the rural communities, debates were sometimes done weekly, and you go to the schoolhouse or a church or whatever, and you know, the whole town would come and they would debate topics. That was kind of like entertainment. He was really good at that. But the newspaper end of things is kind of an offshoot of why the family moves to Caledonia. Another reason is his father, I like to say, is kind of a horse trader. Okay. He's always trading a piece of property for something else, a horse for a cow. It could be anything. And one thing he has traded for is a half interest in a weekly newspaper in Caledonia. It's called the Caledonia Argus. So Warren is working there after school, and he is setting type. He's sweeping the floor. He, you know, literally is getting his hands into the newspaper business, which at that time is a very hands-on type of business when you're talking about, you know, learning the press and everything. He's not writing that much yet. He's only a kid, but he certainly has the smell of ink that's getting to him, and he feels very comfortable there.
He ends up buying the Marion Star newspaper and makes it a very successful small town newspaper. How and when did he purchase it, and what made it so successful?
Well, people in town would have told you that it was a really questionable purchase because he buys it. He's only 19 and he has done with college, which I'll just take a minute to, he goes to a little tiny college, which is between Caledonia and Blooming Grove. It's in a town called Iberia. And strangely enough, it's kind of an educational mecca in the middle of nowhere. And there is an abolitionist who runs it, but it's known, you know, if you go to Ohio Central College, for a rural kid, you're getting a pretty good education. We would equate it to a high school now, but he's there from age 14 to 17. So basically, you're going to school through eighth grade, and then he goes on, which a lot of kids that he grew up with didn't do. So at Ohio Central College, he does start a newspaper on campus called The Spectator. So he does kind of push that newspaper interest forward. So the family picks up and moves again while he's at Ohio Central College. He's almost done with school at the age of 17. The family says, okay, when you're done with school, we've left a donkey for you on the farm. Take that donkey and ride it to Marion. So he's got about 15 miles to ride it, and it takes him quite a long time to get there, but he joins the family there. He can't figure out what he wants to do. So no different than a lot of young people. He thinks, okay, maybe I'll read law. Maybe I'll teach school. And he does teach school for one semester, and he hates it. Absolutely hates it. He says teachers should be paid a lot more for all they have to go through. And then the opportunity comes to buy the Marion Star. Now, it's up for a bid at a sheriff's sale. It's been passed around to who knows how many people. And even though it is called the Marion Daily Star, it has never been published on a daily basis. It was published just when whoever had it at the time when they managed to get it out the door. So it could be twice a week, once every 2 weeks. It had no regular schedule. And it is $300. So he talks two friends into divvying up that purchase price. And he borrows $100 from his dad. One of his friends happens to have some money in his pocket to burn. So he's in, even though he knows nothing about the newspaper business. Warren talks him into it. And then the third person, Jack Warwick, actually has some experience in the newspaper business. And he's the third owner now. And they get this paper, and within a month, the guy who knew nothing about it, he says, I want out. I don't want anything to do with this. Warren buys him out. So he owns two-thirds. Jack Warwick owns one-third. Warren immediately says, this is going to be published daily. You know, we're going to have it live up to its name. It won't be published on Sundays because most smaller papers were not at that time. He basically has everything mortgaged that is in the newspaper office. The press already had debts on it, so he assumes all of that. And the press they called an elbow press because you're using your elbow. You're cranking the press. That's how it's going to print. And the older generation in town, which for them was the Civil War generation. Those, you know, for me or somebody, it would have been the World War II generation. For them, it's the Civil War generation. They think this is hysterical. What does this young kid think he's doing? He can't possibly make a go of this. And every newspaper, of course, makes money from advertising. Well, who in the world's going to advertise in this kind of a a newspaper. So he's got a lot against him right from the start, but he works doggedly at it, and he goes, you know, works hard to try to get some advertising, and it's a very slow process. He eventually buys out Jack Warwick. Jack decided that he actually wanted a regular paycheck, which if you own a small business, you often don't get. And he says, you know, I'm going to stake my life to this newspaper.
Give me an idea of how big that newspaper became. Was it a large circulation? Did he have a staff of reporters? What kind of newspaper was it at the end of the day when it was successful?
Well, at that time, you had your metropolitan newspapers that were primarily on the East Coast. Nothing's really happening on the West Coast at that time. Those are just little, Los Angeles, for example, is a little teeny place. Nobody's really paying attention to the West. And then you had what they called the inland newspapers. That would have been the ones in the small towns all throughout the Midwest and such. Every town had several newspapers at that time. And even in Marion, which was a town of maybe 8,000 when he buys the Star, we had four or five newspapers. And often they were different language newspapers. Like we had one for the Deutsche Press. It was German because we had a lot of German immigrants working in the factories here. It just depended on the cultural makeup of each town. And every newspaper declared its politics. So some were Democrats, some were Republicans, some were socialists. You had a whole variety, and you'd buy the newspaper that matched your politics. He figured, and this is pretty accurate, that about four people would read one issue of the newspaper because they'd pass it around. And that you know, was really pretty true for many, many years in the newspaper business. It wasn't just, yes, you counted those subscribers, but you figured, no, the newspaper actually gets passed to a few more hands by the time it's done. So he builds it to eventually in the 1900s. And so it's up to, you know, 30, 40,000 subscribers. And it's the largest inland newspaper of its size, the most successful, the most financially successful of any inland newspaper in the country. And one of the things that is setting him apart from the others is the editorials he's writing. Then he becomes more respected with other editors from other newspapers and really starts to make kind of a name for himself.
Well, I'm so fascinated by small town newspapers. I'm on the board of the Institute for Rural Journalism and Community Issues at the University of Kentucky. They do work with a lot of small town newspapers today around the country. Not always an easy job now either. So I could go on all day, but I won't. So let me ask you the question then. The big question is when and why did he make the jump from journalism to politics?
Well, the two at the time were very closely connected. Often, if you had a forum, if you're writing editorials and you're the editor of a paper, often that's kind of your springboard to politics. And that's exactly what he did. The decision that he and his wife, Florence, made, he married her in 1891, was that he could entertain his desire to go into public service once the Star's on really solid financial ground. Then he can, you know, because, you know, he had newspapering. It was a very, as I said, a hands-on business. He's got to be there every day. Well, when he gets to the point where he can hire a managing editor, somebody to get the paper out when he's out campaigning or holding public office, that's the only way it's going to work. His newspaper is declared a Republican newspaper. While he'll cover the town news-wise from the editorial product, you know, just like any newspaper with the goings-on in the town, the editorials are going to reflect Republican stands.
So when he jumps into that political arena, he becomes a state senator, lieutenant governor of Ohio.
Yes.
And then in 1914, he goes to the U.S. Senate. So how did he distinguish himself there? And later in his tenure there, he's voting against the Treaty of Versailles. So what led to that vote? And more generally, how did he make a name for himself in the Senate?
I think, and let me get him to the Senate here a minute for you. Yes, he's state senator first. And this is the first election when he's elected in 1899 to the state Senate in which his position, state senators in Ohio, were elected by popular vote. So before that, the legislature would say, you know, in each district, you'd say, okay, Marion County, it's your turn to have somebody from your county be senator. This now things are changing, and now we've got popular vote. So he's the first state senator elected by popular vote. He is making a name for himself. He is highly regarded in the Republican Party in the state. After he's lieutenant governor, he really is considered one of the leaders of the Ohio Republicans. So his name is getting out. I think one of the fallacies about the Harding story in people's minds is that, you know, by the time he's elected president, you know, he comes out of nowhere. Nobody knows who he is. And that's not true. He's very well known, and he's been building steadily, not only the star, but his political expertise. And by the time he's elected United States Senator, he is very well known. And as early as 1916, his name is being bandied about to run in 1920. The idea that he just pops up in 1920 out of nowhere isn't remotely true.
So when that big vote came up with the Treaty of Versailles, was that a party vote, or did he have specific objections to the treaty?
Basically, yes. Republicans are going to be against the League of Nations, basically, which is part of the Treaty of Versailles. And his big problem, as many Republicans had at the time, was an objection to what was called Article 10. Article 10 said that, okay, if you're a member of the League of Nations, and again, that was part of the Treaty of Versailles, if any member nation goes to war, you have to go too. Okay, so this is a problem, because by this time, you know, we are in World War I, we're just getting out of it, and it's very clear to everybody that World War I occurred because of alliances. When, you know, one country, you know, something happens, well, I'm aligned with them, so now I got to go, and they start tumbling like dominoes. You know, a lot of people, and even in the general public in America, they said, well, wait a minute, why would we want to get back into that same situation? We just got out of this war. Harding is actually one of a group of senators who goes to the White House and meets with Woodrow Wilson and said, and they say, well, you know, let's talk about Article 10 here, because it's a little vague what you mean by it. Does it mean that we are legally bound to go to war if a member nation goes to war? And or is it a moral question? You know, what is it? Because it's super important that we make this distinction. And he says, you're going to have to search your hearts. And they're like, well, that doesn't tell us anything. You know, so they're like, well, we can't go forward with this because we don't want to be tied into something and have the country back in the same situation that Europe just experienced. And we know what a mess Europe is in by this time. That is the problem with the League of Nations and thus the Treaty of Versailles. It's because we don't want to be tied into alliances. And Harding himself, and he'll campaign on this, says, you know, I am not opposed to an association of nations. But I don't want us put back in a situation where we are forced to go to war when we, you know, something doesn't involve us. That's not the right vehicle for us. A lot of times, you know, people say, you know, well, he's against, you know, the League of Nations. Well, not really. He's not against the idea of it, but that is not the right mechanism. And Wilson just would not budge on Article 10 at all.
So many things get lost over the years in terms of the fine details of such stories. So that's really, really interesting to learn that. So we have Harding's made a name for himself. He certainly is known. He's not coming out of nowhere. And he gains the Republican nomination and, of course, wins the general election in 1920. Can you give us first an idea of who were his main opponents, both for the Republican nomination and then who was his opponent in the general election?
Well, first, we have to remember that at that time, like the conventions were nothing like our conventions now. I mean, you think now we know who the nominee is. We know that the balloons will come down at precisely 9:37 p.m. Right. There's no real drama to it. Well, back then, it was all about the drama. And you went into the convention not knowing what was going to happen in the end. And there was all kinds of maneuvering in behind closed doors. And, well, I'll support your guy if you throw your delegates this way and all of this. And so at the Republican convention that year, which was in June in Chicago, Harding doesn't expect to be nominated. He goes in as what they call the second, one of the members of the second raters, okay, the second tier candidates. The front runners are Frank Loudon, who is governor of Illinois, and General Leonard Wood, who'd been one of the Rough Riders with Teddy Roosevelt. They kind of cancel each other out. They are front runners, but they neither has enough delegates to win the nomination. And neither will Cave. And then there's some allegations that they've been buying some delegates. So they kind of cancel each other out. Now that opens the door to the second raters, the second tier, which is Warren Harding, it's Calvin Coolidge, it's Herbert Hoover, it's Hiram Johnson, senator from California. Now we're kind of starting the whole process over again at the convention. Okay, with Frank Loudon and Leonard Wood out of the way, now we have to start maneuvering with these guys. And on the 10th round of balloting, Harding secures the nomination. Then the convention does the whole thing all over again to find his running mate. So you don't come in with your own ticket. Calvin Coolidge is selected as Harding's running mate, governor of Massachusetts. Harding, he's acquainted with him, but he doesn't know him really well. So it's not like they've had any discussions or anything like that prior to the convention.
So in the general election, who was his opponent in that general election?
You have now a very interesting lineup. You've got, of course, Harding and Coolidge on the Republican side. The Democrats had their convention a few weeks after the Republicans in San Francisco and took them 44 rounds of balloting, which would be torturous. And they nominate James Cox of Ohio. He's sitting governor of Ohio at this time. He is not only an Ohioan, he's also a newspaper man. He owns the Dayton Daily News and the Springfield News. This is going to be a very unusual election, two Ohio newspaper men battling for the top spot. Interesting, too, that Cox's running mate is Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Assistant Secretary of the Navy under Wilson, and certainly considered the up-and-comer in the Democratic Party. Of these four men, three of them make it to the White House. Only Jim Cox never does, but I always tell people, don't feel sorry for Jim Cox. He does just fine in establishing Cox Communications. That's still around today. He did just fine.
So in the campaign then against Cox and FDR, Harding said he would promote normalcy, restoration, and serenity. What did that mean to the American public, and why did it resonate so well that he was successful in the campaign?
To understand what he meant by that campaign slogan, which is a return to normalcy, we have to look at what America looked like in 1920. Everything that he talked about, that Cox talked about in the campaign, and everything that Harding was going to do in this presidency was tied to World War I. They've just come out of wartime. Of course, it was called the Great War at that time. They didn't know we had to start numbering our wars. So America in 1920 is really floundering. Not only did we come out of war, but we have had no plan to transition from wartime to peacetime as far as our production of goods. Wilson was concentrating on the Treaty of Versailles. So the domestic agenda is kind of left hanging. And there was no transition plan mapped out. And then, of course, he gets his stroke. So everything's just kind of in limbo about, okay, what happens when we stop making war goods? So on Armistice Day, everyone's celebrating. Well, if you were working at a plant that had switched from making one type of good before the war, now you're making some kind of a part for a battleship, they're like, okay, we don't need you anymore. You're likely to get your pink slip. If you are kept on, it was very typical too that your employer might say, well, you know, wartime wages were high because we needed you, Now we're going to go back to pre-war wages. So that does not make you happy. We have high unemployment starting pretty soon after the armistice goes into effect. And companies are losing a tremendous amount of money in war contracts all of a sudden. They lost, in today's money, $40.5 billion in war contracts. And that's, you know, it's not being phased. It's less like everything just stops. Farmers are overextended. They've been encouraged to buy new equipment, buy more land. Here, we'll give you some money from, we'll loan you the money. We want you planting more crops because we got to feed the soldiers in Europe. So they do. And now their silos are full and there's no market. And now the banks are calling in their notes. So there's a lot of farmers losing their land, losing the additional tractors and equipment they had purchased. Cost of living skyrockets. It's 104% in July of 1920, especially on clothing and food. And then add to that we have the soldiers coming home from Europe, and they are demobilized very quickly. So they're coming home in huge numbers to find no jobs. There's no hospitals to treat them if they have physical injuries, if they are shell-shocked. If they're amputees, what are they supposed to do? We don't know. Because our benchmark is still the Civil War. When you hobbled home as best you could, well, now more soldiers, as happens in every war, are surviving because the medical practices improve. Same's true today. But now they're coming home, and what are they supposed to do? How is this blind soldier who got gassed in the trenches of France, what are they supposed to do? So we need more veterans' hospitals. They don't exist. And then add into that, we have all these social issues which have boiled to the top, race issues, because you had black soldiers fighting in Europe who were treated better in Europe than they were in this country. Now they come home and they say, expecting things to be different, and it's not. So now we have race riots in many cities. 1919, that summer is called the Red Summer because of that. So all these things are mixing together. This is what the new president is facing in 1920. So I think, too, we often forget that, you know, between wars, there's a lot going on. We sometimes think, well, if a president wasn't in office during wartime, there wasn't anything going on. And of course, it's not true. So that's what is facing this new president. So return to normalcy, to swing back to that. What he means by that is we need to get back to a normal way of living. Some historians have interpreted that to mean he thinks that we ought to get back to the way things were before the war. And he's not that naive. He knows that's not happening. He means a normal way of living as far as industry in our country getting revved up again. He means us feeling secure about where our nation is going. He means us going to work and kind of assuming our normal routine without looking over our shoulder to see what else is going to happen. That's what he means by a return to normalcy.
When he gets into office, he said at one point he was going to bring less government in business and more business in government. So how was that idea manifested in his domestic policies as president?
I think what you have with him, of course, and that's a, you know, basic Republican view at the time, that you want a smaller government, that, and you're going to put mechanisms in place to encourage business to grow on its own. This is what he's going to propose. He's going to start off as president with the domestic agenda, more emphasis on that. To help those farmers, he's going to increase the tariffs. Now, tariffs aren't super popular today, but back then that was a pretty standard thing to do. He's going to lower taxes because coming out of the war, we, of course, have a huge national deficit. So we want to lower taxes, we want to give everyone a chance, but we're also going to work on reducing that federal deficit. He's going to install a national budget system, and this he's going to call the Bureau of the Budget. This is something completely different than's ever been done. And he's going to put Charles Dawes in charge of it. And basically, Dawes is like the gatekeeper. And he's going to go to each federal agency and make them justify what they are asking for money-wise. And that had never been done before. Strangely enough, in Congress, they would just get this huge stack of requests from all the federal agencies, and then they would just go through, but they didn't really have a good idea of what it looked like altogether. And Harding thought that was kind of silly. He said, I just run a little business in Marion, Ohio, and I have to balance my books. And so I don't understand why we're not doing that for the federal government. So the Bureau of the Budget is supposed to handle that budget. And Dawes does an excellent job in there. And he says that, you know, he tells Harding, he says, I'm only doing this for a couple of years because everybody's basically going to hate my guts by the end of it. But he does a great job with it. And Harding is also interested in getting rid of duplication in federal jobs. So we want to streamline things. So that's part of that as well. Harding wants to create a strong merchant marine. So after the war, it is absolutely a given that this is a global economy. And sometimes people say, well, Harding's an isolationist. No, he's not. And they say that because he's against the League of Nations. And we already talked about that. He is not an isolationist. He says we are connected to, you know, people throughout the world, whether you like it or not. That's the way of the world. But we don't have a strong merchant marine to move goods around. He never gets that accomplished, never gets that pushed through Congress. He wants to reduce railway rates. Of course, rail is essential to the domestic economy, create new farm credit legislation, get the farmers back on their feet. And then this will surprise a lot of people, tighten immigration controls. That is a given that's going to happen. Both the Democrats and Republicans want immigration tightened. And that has a direct result of the Russian Revolution, which has taken place. A lot of poor, unskilled, uneducated immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. Basically, we're saying, you know, we can't take on this burden, and we're going to tighten that up. It is thought to be a success during the Harding administration, so much that Coolidge tightens it even more. It's just going to happen. There's nobody really arguing against it.
Well, let me ask you this. In terms of these domestic policies, given the kind of economic turmoil he faced when he was elected, did things improve? Inflation, employment, that type of thing?
They did. Within 2 years, he had cut the national deficit by 25%. The economy is rolling again. He largely is credited for turning that post-war worldwide recession in the United States, starting to turn that around. So he makes a tremendous impact in getting things under control and kind of setting America on a new course.
Let's turn for a minute to his foreign and military policy. I know the Harding administration hosted the Washington Naval Conference, was it 21 to 22? What was accomplished specifically at that conference, and what did that reflect about his approach to foreign and military policies?
Well, the Washington Disarmament Conference, it goes by a lot of different names, but it opens the day after he dedicates the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and he thinks that is a perfect tie-in because we are paying tribute, of course, to this unnamed soldier at the same time that we're saying, okay, we are basically opening a peace conference. And this is the first peace conference the world has ever seen. And basically, they are talking about, they realize, he and the other leaders of the countries who attend, realize that in order to form a lasting peace in the world, we have got to address the weapons of mass destruction. And in those days, the choice weapon was the battleship. They worked through several months. And this is the part I think, too, is remarkable about Harding. Of course, he goes and opens up the conference. He says those people who assume that we're going to back out of this new world order and just tend to ourselves in this country are mistaken. We want to be a part of what's going on in the world. And he also gives the introductory address, welcomes everybody, and then he backs out of it and he turns it over to his Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes. Now, he does this for a very simple reason, and that is because he wants them actually to get some work done. He wants the politics out of it. Good luck, but he does want it out of it. And wants them to work on his own without, you know, having to address the press every day about, you know, oh, what happened today and what did you just decide on? No, he wants them to get some work done. Now, Hughes keeps him informed, of course, every day, but he's not in the discussions every day. I think it's kind of remarkable because he isn't at all interested in taking credit. He wants this to work. He's not that interested in just making himself the central figure. And I think that speaks a lot to what he was like as a human being as well. The negotiations start out, well, before the negotiations, I want to read you one thing he addressed the conference. He says, "Gentlemen of the conference, the United States welcomes you with unselfish hands. We harbor no fears. We have no sordid ends to serve. We suspect no enemy. We contemplate or apprehend no conquest. Content with what we have, we seek nothing which is another's. We only wish to do with you that finer, nobler thing which no nation can do alone. We wish to sit with you at the table of international understanding and goodwill. In good conscience, we are eager to meet you frankly and invite and offer cooperation. The world demands a sober contemplation of the existing order and the realization that there can be no cure without sacrifice, not by one of us, but by all of us." This is where he leaves them and he says, okay, get to work. So they, after several months of working, come up with a series of treaties, and they're pretty complicated, but they're based on adjusting the ratio of battleships you have. So even the United States, according to what's outlined, is forced to scuttle several battleships. This is trying to create a more balanced playing field for the world. So nobody has more than their share and is going to start attacking somebody else. This is supposed to even it out and maybe, just maybe, create a period where everyone is more focused on peace than on stockpiling. Because right at the end of World War I, what has happened is what you would imagine happen. Everybody starts rearming themselves and building more weapons. And it's like, no, here we go again. Europe is so unstable. It looked to many people likely that a war could break out the next week because they were so torn apart. And it's like, okay, we got to stop everything right now and try. Whether it's going to work or not, we have to try to make this a lasting peace. The significance of the treaties by World War II were downgraded. They were hailed as extremely successful in the years right after they were settled. The problem by then was that bad faith on behalf of several of the attending nations superseded what Charles Evans Hughes called the will to have peace. So in other words, if a nation intended to circumvent a treaty, it was going to find a way. At the time, though, in the 20s, it did restore a balance among nations in that post-war period.
Fascinating. So we'll turn from that good story, really, of good intentions and actually good results to a story I know that I'm sure you've had to talk quite a bit about, and that's the Teapot Dome scandal. Looms pretty large in the story of the Harding administration. Can you just outline for our listeners what was involved in that scandal and how did Harding know about it? How was he involved? What was his knowledge of the Teapot Dome scandal?
Teapot Dome involved Harding's Secretary of the Interior, Albert Fall, and he was the Interior Secretary. Albert Fall had been a senator, came into the Senate when Harding did in 1915. They sat fairly near each other in the Senate. Became friends. Albert Fall was very highly thought of. And in fact, he was confirmed as Secretary of the Interior unanimously. When do we ever hear of that? there's nothing, you know, that people are thinking anything badly about him or anything. Teapot Dome is a real place. It is a kind of a knob of rock in Wyoming that at one time people thought it looked like a teapot. But ironically, this is your fun fact for the day, the handle of the alleged teapot came off in a tornado at some point. So if you look for the teapot, it's not going to, it'll look like a broken teapot. So anyways, this was federally owned land. And at that time, just like today, it was perfectly fine for the federal government to lease lands to oil company for oil production. In 1920, still during Wilson's tenure, the General Leasing Act was passed, which allowed this. So that was perfectly fine. That wasn't the problem. You had two men, Albert Fall, Interior, who is supervising the federal lands. Then you had Edwin Denby, who was head of Navy. He and Albert Fall decided that it made more sense to put the land that Navy was responsible for in Interior too. So all the federal lands would be in one place. Teddy Roosevelt Jr. and Edward Denby and Albert Fall came to the White House and they told the president, okay, we want to move these lands so they're all under Interior. We think that makes the most sense. Navy had lands too that were had oil reserves on them. And President Harding said, this is what you want to do? Yeah, we think it'd be more efficient this way. Okay, well, that's what we're trying to do in this administration. He signs off on it. He signs an executive order. That is Warren Harding's role in Teapot Dome. Okay, so what happens then is that Albert Fall signs leases allowing some of the land to be drilled to oil companies. One is Sinclair, and if you've I was just in Colorado not long ago, and there they still have the Sinclair stations with the dinosaur. That's the same company. And the other guy's name was Doheny. So Sinclair and Doheny. Albert Fall had known them for a long time. They had somehow been involved in a silver mine in Mexico years and years and years before. Anyways, they are given leases to drill on this federal land at Teapot Dome. The problem that came to light was that Albert Fall had given the leases without using the open bid process. Okay, he just awarded the leases without advertising them like governments have to do. That is the problem with Teapot Dome. So what happens is, and this is after, there's in 1922, there's the first little article in the New York Times about Teapot Dome and these leases, but nobody's thinking much about any problems or anything like that. Well, Albert Fall resigns in early 23. He'd planned to do that. It wasn't like he all of a sudden decided to. He had told Harding that's how much he wanted to work. And then this starts gaining momentum that right after Harding's death in August 1923, we have hearings to get to the bottom of whatever's going on with Teapot Dome and these leases. So there's congressional investigations, there's hearings, and then there are several trials, basically accusing Albert Fall of taking a bribe. And it's a very complicated story. I'm giving you the very watered down version. That he has taken a $100,000 bribe from these two oilmen, Sinclair and Doheny, to make improvements on his ranch he owned in New Mexico. And it said that, oh, he took that in exchange for giving these guys the leases. So they have several trials, and they have several because they always ended in a deadlock jury or there was nothing brought against them. It's in the news all of the 20s. So people are like, Teapot Dome, you know, we don't know what it is exactly, but we know it's bad. And we know it has something to do with Harding. We don't know exactly what. Well, it really didn't have anything to do with Harding, except it happened on his watch, which if you borrow from Harry Truman, the buck stops here. Okay, it's one of his guys. They get to the end of the 20s. You had a lot of colorful characters testifying at these trials. It was good drama, no matter how you looked at it. And Albert Fall at one point says he can't come because he has sinus trouble and his health starts breaking. I mean, it's just a made-for-TV movie. So we get to the end of the 20s, and finally we have a trial that results in some verdicts. And Albert Fall is found guilty of accepting this bribe. But the oil men are acquitted of giving him the bribe. Of course, it makes zero sense. But Albert Fall does become the first cabinet member in American history to go to jail. He goes for just about 4 months. His health is broken by that time, but he is found guilty. And that has, so Teapot Dome has always been synonymous with Harding, but that's, it really was Albert Fall's thing.
As you noted, in 1923, President Harding died. Can you tell us the circumstances of his death? What did he die from?
He died in the midst of a trip to Alaska in the Western states. He left Washington in June 1923. The trip had been postponed from the year before. He's supposed to go in 22, but there were rail and coal strikes that were on the horizon, which in the summer previous. So he was stuck in Washington trying to help sort those out because the nation would be crippled if either of those happened. So it's postponed till 23. He calls this trip the Voyage of Understanding. It's a very simple premise. He wants to see how those normalcy policies are working. This is where we see Harding, the newspaper man, coming into view and merging with a president, because he wants to talk to the people. He wants to gather information. You know, this is the newspaper man in him. I got to see what's happening. I want to see if people are being helped or doing, or maybe we're going down the wrong avenue here. So the final goal is to go to Alaska. He's going there. It's a territory, of course, at that time. And he's going there because there's particular concern about the natural resources in both the fishing industry there and, of course, as we know today, oil and other natural resources. He has asked, and he asked months before he went on the trip from his federal agencies, I want you to give me a report on your view of what's going on in Alaska. So he gets all these reports and they all contradict each other. And he says, you know, I'm just going to go myself and see what's going on. So he takes several cabinet members with him because his plan is to let, you know, like Hoover, who's in commerce, he wants them to meet with the native Alaskans who are being killed by, not literally killed, being hurt by what we are doing in the fishing industry. They're losing their livelihood. He wants several meetings along the way. So he and his entourage start out by train. He's on his train car, the Superb, which is a Pullman car that's outfitted for him. And they head west. And they're stopping in little towns along the way. He's giving about 14 major speeches along the way. But all along the way, there's all these requests coming in to the presidential party. Well, can he stop and speak at this Kiwanis meeting? Can he stop? And he hated to disappoint people. And he said, well, yeah, if they want me to speak with them at least a few minutes, I will, because this might be the only chance these people have to meet their president. So it just snowballs into he's giving dozens and dozens of speeches along the way. Now, let me back up a second. Before he's left Washington, he's already experiencing a lot of what we would know today as symptoms of heart disease. They don't recognize it then, because cardiac medicine is really not recognized yet. He is experiencing shortness of breath. He has experienced an inability to sleep. He can't lie down. He feels like he's got an elephant on his chest. He's always had high blood pressure, had it from his time he was in his 20s. It's extraordinarily high, but there's nothing to do about it anyway. There's no such thing as the blood pressure medicine. He's just thinking, well, I'm just tired. I just need to, maybe I can rest on this trip. Well, it's just the opposite with all these speeches and everything. He goes across the country. They go to Alaska. He really loves Alaska, absolutely loves it. And he sees these little houses that have been built. And he thinks he's bought back his family farm in Blooming Grove. And he says, I think I'm going to put one of those at the farm. And he wants to install 9 holes of golf on his farmland that he now owns again. So he thinks that'd be a great hangout. He is predicting statehood for Alaska, which is well before it occurs, of course. And he's excited to go back to Washington and create new policies which will balance the natural resources as far as what we're going to use and then what we're going to protect. So he's getting that balance between conserving the natural resources and using them in a responsible manner. He is very excited about crafting those new policies, but he doesn't make it. In Washington and Seattle, he's giving a speech and he falters, kind of stumbles a little bit. The audience doesn't notice, but they get him back to the train car pretty quickly to check him out. And his Navy physician, just by feeling his chest, detects an enlarged heart. They make the decision to go straight to San Francisco. They're, like I told you before, the towns are not huge along the West Coast, even by the early 20s. When they go to San Francisco, they're going to get in touch with Dr. Lyman at Stanford. And he is a cardiologist, one of the few in the country. So they said, we need you to meet us there. So the train goes straight to San Francisco. Group stops at the Palace Hotel in San Francisco. Harding is put in the presidential suite on the 8th floor. So for the next few days, it's really a matter of monitoring him, giving him rest, seeing if they can get a little food down him and see if he can pull out of this. There's nothing really to treat him with. They give him digitalis, which heart patients still can get today. And it's just a matter of seeing if he can regain his strength. And they're talking about, well, where are we going to take him so he can recuperate? And so they're having those discussions. And by August 2nd, it's looking like he's out of the woods. In fact, he tells his sister that. She's living in California, and she comes to visit him. And he says, you know, I think I am. I think I'm out of the woods. And everybody's kind of breathing a sigh of relief. The press aren't hanging around the door of the presidential suite. His doctors go down to the dining room to get some dinner. And Florence is reading a magazine article to him. It's called A Calm Review of a Calm Man. He says, that's good. Keep going. And he gives a little shudder and he dies. It was shocking to the nation. I know it's kind of a hard thing with everything we've heard about Harding since his death over the past 100 years, but he was a much beloved president. And it was absolutely shocking to people that this had happened because, you know, they had been putting out regular bulletins about from his doctors. And they were like, yeah, I think, you know, we think he's on the mend. His medical records we have from that whole trip. And we have a thing called a Harding Symposium every year in conjunction with Ohio State University. And one year we did it about the Western trip. One of the Harding family members, Dr. Richard Harding, he's in South Carolina. He's a grandnephew of the president. And he gave the medical records to several cardiologists he knew. And he gave a wonderful presentation just interpreting those medical records and saying, okay, this is what's happening. His respiration is this high. That means he's really panting at this point. He cannot get his breath. It was really enlightening, as you know, from a layman's standpoint as to understanding what he's going through. The whole thing is he's got congestive heart failure. You know, he has a heart attack. They said it was apoplexy on his death certificate, which is stroke. That was kind of the diagnosis it was pretty standard at that time because there were doctors that really didn't believe that there were such things as a heart attack yet, you know, and nobody understood if the bad heart was creating the symptoms or if the symptoms were creating the bad heart. So it's very, very early in cardiac medicine.
You mentioned earlier, Sherry, that in the years since, in addition to Teapot Dome, when you hear Warren Harding, you hear about his alleged infidelity. So that question for you is, in terms of his relationship with Florence, what was that relationship like? And are there facts behind those infidelities? Or is that, again, a myth that's grown over this 100 years?
A little of both. His relationship with Florence is a complicated one. They marry in 1891. She is 5 years older than him. So when they marry, he's 25, she's 30. She has been divorced and has a 10-year-old son named Marshall. She is also the daughter of Marion's richest man. And, you know, a self-made man, can't take anything away from Amos Kling, but not exactly the easiest guy to get along with. He's the guy that you need in any of your financial endeavors, but you kind of grit your teeth as you do it. I know a lot of people say, oh, that's why Harding married Florence, for her money. That's not true. Harding knew that Amos Kling did not want his daughter to marry him. And Amos Kling said, you know, if this marriage goes through, Florence, you're not getting anything. And she said, okay, fine. And she turns on her heel and walks out of his house. Harding knew he wasn't going to cash in or anything. Florence is a great believer in Warren Harding. She bolsters him a lot as far as his newspaper career, his political career. I mean, she works at the Marion Star for 12 years. She's good at accounting. She realigns the home delivery system. She takes some things off his plate so he can concentrate on the editorial product. And she calls it the family business. She's very smart. She understands politics. She's interested in politics. She loves to learn about world affairs. So she's a little out of step with many women at her time in history. She's very comfortable in a man's world. She is not that woman who is crocheting in the front parlor. That is not Florence Harding. When he enters politics, she does what she can to push him forward. She is not, however, behind his decision to run for president, which is another myth. Everyone says, well, Florence Harding pushed him in. No, she didn't. She did not want him to run. She said, we're fine here in the Senate. This, you know, Senate life's pretty cushy. You don't need to do this. The decision at the time was, if you're asked to serve, you serve. It wasn't like a personal goal of his ever to be president. Once he decides, then she says, all right, I'm all in then. And then she does whatever she can for him. A lot of historians, a lot of books will say, oh, there was no love in their marriage, everything. Well, we don't know that because they didn't write it down, say, hey, there's no love in our marriage or anything. They didn't. There are no letters that between the two of them that exist. I can make educated guesses that they probably didn't have the most romantic relationship. I think that he valued her judgment. I think he valued her belief in him. I think she certainly loved him. I don't know about how deep his feelings ran for her. He was asked to divorce her. When we talk about the infidelity, I'll get into that. And he refused. He said, no, I'm not doing that. What we do see is when they are in the White House, they grow closer and closer. And maybe it's because they're in the fishbowl. You know, we do see renewed bonding between them. She also has a lot of health problems. I mean, the two of them are not the healthiest people in the world. She has chronic kidney disease. She develops that in the early 1900s and has it for the rest of her life. So there are times when she is bedridden. She nearly dies the fall of 22 when they're in the White House. He is basically setting up camp right outside her door. His behavior then tells me a lot that there is affection there. There is loyalty there. He is very distraught over her illness. I don't know about anything else. And anybody who says they do, I don't know what they're basing it on. As far as infidelities, yes, there were two. One involved a woman named Carrie Phillips. And Carrie Phillips and her husband, Jim, were good friends of Lawrence and Florence's. They would travel together, socialize together. Carrie was reputed to be the most beautiful woman in Marion. After Florence's kidney disease started, she was hospitalized in Columbus. And during that time, Carrie's son, who was just two, died. And Carrie and Warren were commiserating. And they grew very close and had an emotional connection. There was nothing physical at that point. In 3 years, it would become physical. So 1908, is when they begin a physical relationship. We know this because there are letters that Harding wrote to Carrie that were unsealed in 2014. Harding was very good in his letters about recapping what the conversation had been. It's like when he and Carrie had last written or talked. They had a 10-year on-again, off-again relationship. They didn't see each other all that often. She's in Marion, and then she becomes a German sympathizer, and she and her daughter move to Germany. So this would be about 1912-ish, and they're living there until war breaks out. She and her husband Jim are really marriage in name only. There's not much relationship there. It seems that Florence learns of the relationship in 1913. So she knew about it. But by the time Warren enters the White House, it's completely fizzled out. Meanwhile, though, right after that final break, about 1918, with Carrie, there is a young woman named Nan Britton, who is from Marion. She is in her early 20s. So he's in the Senate at that time. She's in her early 20s. So he's in his early 50s. He had known and been good friends with her father. She had, as a kid, like 13, 14 years old, developed this huge crush on him in Marion. And she would, you know, be across the street of the Star office waiting for him to walk home. And then she'd accidentally run into him and all these things. She would call on the telephone, and if Florence answered, she'd hang up and ring the doorbell and again act like she was going to see Florence. But it was to the point where women in town were telling Nan's mother, you really need to get your daughter under control. So Nan, after she graduates from high school, she writes to Senator Harding saying, hey, do you know of any secretarial jobs? Which people did all the time, you know, do you know of anything? And he said, well, I know of a couple. There's one in New York. I know somebody there. So she takes this job in New York, and she settles in there. And then when he's in New York on business, he goes to see her, and they have these sexual trysts. Nan becomes pregnant, but she's also been seeing a couple other guys at the same time. She has this child, little girl, Elizabeth Ann, in New Jersey, and this is before he's in the White House. She tells him it's his child. She writes a book in 1927 called The President's Daughter, and she's outlined this whole relationship because she is very in love with him and always was and all this. I think there's two things going on. I think the book, the circumstances of the relationship are embellished to be, I don't think the relationship was as long as she thinks, as she says it was. There are allegations that her publisher at the time did juice up the book a lot, but you have to separate that from the child. For whatever it's been, 70, 80 years, we would have told you at the Harding sites, if people said, well, is he really, did he really father this child? We would have said, we don't know. Because, you know, there was no proof or anything. After Warren's death, she was certain there was money for her somewhere. And she talked to a couple of Warren's sisters and said, okay, this is what's going on. This child belongs to him. There's got to be money somewhere. And they're like, well, there's nothing in his will or anything. And so they would help give her some money because they'd known her all her life. Well, his brother then is upset because he sees this as his sisters are being blackmailed. So he talks to her and says, do you have any proof? Do you have any hotel receipts? Do you have any letters? No, she says, I don't have anything. He also knows what she was like when she was chasing him around as a young teenager. He agonizes over this decision of whether to believe her or not, and finally decides there's nothing that leads him to believe it's true. She sues the Harding estate, and she loses in federal court because there isn't any proof. So fast forward to 2015, one of her Nan's grandsons and two Harding grandniece and a grandnephew decide they're going to work through Ancestry.com. They're going to take DNA tests and see if they are related. And it shows that they are second cousins, Nan with the other two cousins. That's as close as you're going to get. There are no paternity tests. We can't, you know, we can't do that. So the very next day after we learned that information, we changed what we said. We said, yeah, apparently it's true. I separate the two. I say, okay, it's true that he fathers her daughter, but I'm not as convinced that her rendition of the relationship is exactly true.
All right, Sherry, I have just a couple cultural questions about POTUS 29 now. Ohio is called the mother of presidents, eight of them from the Buckeye State: Harrison, Grant, Hayes, Garfield, Harrison, McKinley, Taft, and Harding. I'm sure you think Harding was the best of these eight. So let's hear you defend your guy. Why was Harding better than all the other Ohio presidents?
All I can say about Harding, and you know, the Ohio presidents each filled a certain role when each was president. All I can tell you is I absolutely believe this, is he was the right guy for his time in history. I think he was a bridge from the war to kind of getting America back on a straight path again. Until you start diving into that time in history, you don't realize how insecure Americans felt coming out of the war. You know, we've heard of the lost generation, F. Scott Fitzgerald and everything, and it's absolutely is true that people just didn't know what to expect, what was around the next corner. World War One, they're like, it reminds me of Vietnam a lot. You know, what happened and what did we gain? The same kind of thing then. And so I think his return to normalcy, this, you know, he says restoration, not turning everything upside down to get ahead, but let's just calm down. Everything's going to be okay. That message worked. And his personality was such that he just had that very calming influence on people. And I just think that's what was needed at the time. He did accomplish a tremendous amount of things in a very short 29-month presidency that most people have never heard.
On the personal side, what were some of Harding's hobbies? He was quite the golfer and musician, right?
He was, and he didn't play golf till he was in the Senate, so not till 1915. We didn't have golf courses out in the hinterlands. He loved it. He thought it was a good game if he broke 100. We have a lot of his golf clubs in our collections.
And what kind of musical instruments did he play?
He played nearly every brass instrument and played in town bands. So small towns at that time, Marion had several of them too. You had town bands and you go to competitions or play at the July 4th picnics or whatever. And he was the leader of this one band when he was in Caledonia. So always had appreciation for music. He liked and knew John Philip Sousa. So he liked the marches. He liked those kind of musics. Florence tended toward the classical music because she was a classically trained pianist at the Conservatory of Cincinnati. So music is very much a part of both of their lives. He loved baseball, was not a great baseball player when he was a kid, but he loved baseball. And when he and Florence would go to a game, even when they're in the White House, they go to watch senators' games, and they each would keep book. They each would keep score, which I'm impressed by when the first lady's keeping her book. I think that's cool. Good friends with Babe Ruth. Babe Ruth visited the White House 7 times during the Harding presidency. You know, he liked to play horseshoes. He liked to play cards. And yes, he did play poker. He also played bridge, and they would bet with nickels on the bridge games.
Sounds like a very competitive guy.
Yes. Well, you know, he liked hanging around with guys. He really did. He belonged to fraternal organizations, as many men did at that time. That was your social life. He liked guy things a lot.
So how was he as a dresser? Was he kind of rough and tumble like Lincoln, or was he more dapper like Chester Arthur?
Oh, he's always going to be dapper, especially Florence around. She always made sure that he was dressed the right way. She took great pride in his appearance.
Now, he might not have a monument on the National Mall in D.C., but there is quite the enormous and impressive monument and tomb in Ohio. Can you tell us how this very large thing came about.
Yeah, it is the largest memorial to a president outside of Washington. It would be right at home on the Mall in Washington. After his death in August of 23, there was a group formed. President Coolidge was the honorary chairman, and it was called the Harding Memorial Association. And their function was to start raising money across the country to build some kind of a final memorial gravesite for the president. They went to work, they raised money, so it was all private money, and there was consideration about putting it in Washington. But his friends here in Marion said, no, this is where his heart was. He should be here. And they're right. They made the right decision. So the memorial, it is huge. It was designed by an architect out of Pennsylvania. They had kind of a competition. It was built on a former farm. The Memorial Association bought the land, and it was built here in Marion. It's made of white Georgian marble. It is beautiful. Mrs. Harding is in tomb there as well. She actually helped pick out the land. It has a slight rise in the land, and we are kind of in the flatlands here, so getting any kind of a rise is very good. But it's a beautiful, beautiful place. It's 10 acres. It's situated on 10 acres and in the country when it was built, but now the town's kind of grown around it.
Nice. And Sherry, finally, we've really loved having you on. Tell us about the Harding Library and Harding Home. Just north of Columbus, right?
Yeah, we're about an hour north of Columbus, right? Easy to get to. The Harding Home has been open to the public since 1926. It opened just 3 years after the president died of his heart attack. So it was operated by the Harding Memorial Association, the private group, until 1979. It financially just could not go on anymore, and it was transferred to the state of Ohio. And it's now under the control of the Ohio History Connection, which is the fairly new name of the Ohio Historical Society. So we had that, we had the memorial, and then just a year ago in May, we opened the doors to the new Warren G. Harding Presidential Library and Museum. It's just adjacent to the Harding Home, and gives us so much more ability to tell his story and to show folks not only what was going on, the entire story of his presidency and earlier life, but they can see so many more of the historical objects we have. We have nearly 6,000 original objects, things that belong to the Hardings, and that's the most of any presidential site in the country. We have Florence Harding to thank for that, because she died just 15 months after he did, and she changed her will after his death, so that the house and the majority of objects in it would go to the Harding Memorial Association. Our story is not the same as a lot of the presidential sites, even like Monticello or stuff where they fell into disrepair and then you have a group come, you know, fix it back up, then go in search of historical things to put in it. Our things, we kind of froze in time in 1923. I give all the credit to Florence. Without her changing her will like that, I don't know what would have happened.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And you're open year-round?
We are open year-round. Our website is HardingPresidentialSites, that's plural, .org.
Perfect. And we'll link to that on our website as well. Sherry, we can't thank you enough for taking the time. You've been terrific.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me to do this. A lot of people think, well, he was president for such a short time. What is there to know? Well, every president has their own story to tell, and he's no different.
I was really glad to talk with Sherry Hall about President Warren Harding. He's a president largely unknown by the public today, and on those rare occasions when his name does come up, it's typically mentioned in the context of his flaws, his affairs, and his administration's scandals. Now, he did indeed have flaws, and certain members of his administration were certainly guilty of misdeeds. In most analyses of presidents, Harding is somewhere near the bottom tier, in the company of others like James Buchanan or Franklin Pierce or Andrew Johnson. But if our American POTUS conversations teach us anything, it is that there's always more to the story. Harding emerged in our conversation with Sherry as a fascinating man who left behind his shared successes along with his failures. And more generally, we cannot understand post-World War I America if we don't analyze the Harding administration in its full complexity. Simply writing it off as a failure, as just a mix of secret liaisons and dirty deals, misses a great deal that is fundamentally important in understanding the state of our nation and the world in the 1920s.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the American POTUS Podcast. We'd like to thank Sherry Hall for joining us on this episode about Warren G. Harding. More information on the Harding presidential sites can be found on AmericanPOTUS.org. And we would like to thank all of you that have made a tax-deductible financial contribution to support this podcast. In addition to this show, your generosity helps us develop new groundbreaking podcast shows and revolutionary outreach programs, offering clarity and perspective to today's political conversations. If you'd like to contribute, it's easy. Simply visit AmericanPOTUS.org. We appreciate your help. American POTUS is produced by American History Studios, graphic design by Proudler Design, and original music score by Jonathan Clark Music. Finally, it's our presidential last word from Warren Harding, quote, "I have no trouble with my enemies. I can take care of my enemies in a fight, but my friends, they're the ones who keep me walking the floor at nights."